Welcome to a new episode of Land Grant Holyland in Conversation. My name is Matt Tamanini. On this podcast, we talk to people in and around Ohio State athletics and the sporting world at large to bring you a different insight and perspective to the teams, athletes, and university that you love. On today's episode, we are in conversation with one of LGHL's favorite alumni, Patrick Mayhorn. Since departing the hallowed halls of Land Grant Holyland, Patrick has ascended to the rank of associate editor at the esteemed Buckeye Sports Bulletin. He's also launched his own newsletter, Outside Zone, and launched his own podcast, Flipping the Field. And yes, we will have links to all of these in the show notes. It has been nearly 2 years, I think, since I did a podcast with Patrick, so it was great to catch back up with him and to pick his brain about the Ohio State roster, what position groups he's concerned about most, the players he expects to pop, the future of the quarterback position, and a number of other Buckeye-related topics. Then, we also get into one of Patrick's true passions, G5 football. We discuss his newsletter project of breaking down every single G5 team during this offseason, what G5 team could potentially contend for a playoff berth before, of course, being completely overlooked and disrespected by the committee, and much, much more. If you weren't following LGHL when Patrick was our lead voice and co-host with the great Colton Denning on Hangout in the Holy Land, I'm sorry you missed out on that era, but both of those guys have been immortalized in a very small way in the distinguished alumni section on the masthead page of our website if you want to take a stroll through LGHL history. So, with all of that out of the way, here's my conversation with Patrick Mayhorn. I can't believe I'm saying this, but Patrick Mayhorn, welcome back to the Land Grant Holy Land podcast feed, man.
I'm so happy to be back. It's like it's like walking back into your old house, right? And they've changed up the doors a little bit. They've repainted it, but it still has that same feeling to it. It's so nice to be home. Yeah. Matt, how's it going?
I'm doing great. And I got to tell you, I am a devoted and regular listener to the BSB Buckeye Sports Bulletin podcast with you and Wyatt Crozier. So it's like, even though we haven't talked, especially on podcast form in a while, I feel like I'm still getting the full Patrick Mayhorn experience over at the BSB podcast. So I appreciate that. And congratulations on the new promotion. You are what, the now the grand poobah of BSB? What's your official title?
Yeah, I'm the Shah.
I'm the czar.
I've been named dictator of BSB. Wyatt and I are associate editors at BSB. Wyatt is the associate editor responsible primarily for online coverage. I am the associate editor for print, which essentially just means that I set the stories that we put in the paper and set up what the page layout is going to look like. We've only been doing it for a couple weeks, but it's been a good time. I've been enjoying it, and it's certainly been a challenge, but it's been fun. And then Wyatt is a good time to work with, if you couldn't pick up from our podcast that we do together, but it's been fun. We're out of bi-weekly papers now, so we have a little bit more time onto the monthly schedule, but we were sort of learning on the fly, flying by the seat of our pants a little bit, and we're out of the worst of it now, so it's been a good time. I've been enjoying my time here.
And you will pick up hot and heavy for the football season, doing two papers a week, and they come out on Mondays starting when?
Not two papers a week, one paper a week, thankfully. Yes. Bi-weekly is every other week.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. That's a very confusing term. That's a very confusing term, because it could go either way.
I will say, thank God it is not two papers a week. That would be one paper a week is already a whole lot. I believe we pick that up once the season actually starts. We go back to bi-weekly. Yes. We go back to bi-weekly in August, but we are monthly through August. We have a June issue. We just put out a May issue. We have a June issue and then a July issue. But then we are back to weekly once we get around to the season, which is always sort of chaos mode is when we're on the weekly papers.
Yeah. And so just to be clear, since I live, as you know, in Florida, like I can still get the paper down here, right?
Yes, all 50 states. I believe if you live somewhere in the world and you want BSB, we will set you up. Nice. We have lots of people down in Florida. We have lots of people all over the place. I believe we got a call yesterday from Wyoming. We just oh, nice. it's uh yeah, we've been dealing with the post office and all that entails in the last couple of years, but it gets out there. So if you're interested, it's available to anyone that lives in the States, at least for sure. And I think we might have some overseas as well.
Yeah, you got to get that stamps.com sponsorship for the podcast and stuff. Yeah. And send those things out. All right, so that's all of the businessy stuff that I wanted to get out of the way first. But BSB's main focus is covering Ohio State, and obviously football is at the front and center of that. And we are now just, I guess, 3 weeks removed from the spring game. And I wanted to kind of get your parting shots and your parting thoughts after we kind of saw everything that we saw during the spring, both in terms of practices, interviews, and the game itself. Do you want to talk about the good stuff first or the bad stuff first, Patrick?
We could start with the bad stuff. That's always sort of been my cup of tea. So we can do that.
All right. So I know that both you and Wyatt, and specifically you, have your concerns about what Ohio State's defensive backs will look like in year two of, I guess, phase two of the Kerry Combs experience. I think a lot of people are interested, at least because of all of the younger guys who might have some opportunities to get some playing time after being hyped up as coming in as recruits. But from what I gather, you're still not sold that this specific defensive secondary is going to return to the BIA form that Ohio State fans are used to.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I'm not quite as low on the secondary as I was entering spring. I was encouraged by some of the stuff that I saw throughout the spring, some of the stuff that we heard. Given if it's an Ohio State coach talking, you have to take it with a grain of salt.
Sure.
But I'm encouraged by the idea of shifting to something resembling the 4-2-5 with Craig Young as that bullet, or Ronnie Hickman, both of whom looked very good this spring. I'm interested in that. I'm not sure that it's quite as cutting edge as they maybe think it is, given that it's, 2021, and this is sort of the base defense for most teams at this point. But yeah. It is still a step in the right direction, certainly, to not be playing four linebackers against most teams. And I think that I have been encouraged by that, and I'm intrigued by that. My main hang up with the secondary is just the guys that are in it. There's a lot of guys who either have been around the program and haven't really done a whole lot, guys like Tyreek Johnson, guys like Marcus Hooker, who it seems like is still on the team. Not sure what's really going on there. Yeah, technically on the team. And other older guys who have played but haven't really done a ton in terms of like productive on the field product in 7 Banks's case or Josh Proctor's case. They're fine. I think both of them were fine in 2020, but this is still a secondary without a definitive star, and in losing someone who was considered to be the star, at least entering last season, and Sean Wade. Obviously Sean Wade didn't quite live up to those expectations, but it's still, this is a relatively inexperienced secondary without a player in it who I think we can definitively trust as being someone good and someone who can be relied on in big game situations. And that's my primary concern with the defense at large, is that the established name on this defense is Haskell Garrett. And then I don't think there's really a number two behind him. Like Tyreek Smith is kind of on that level. Yeah. Zach Harrison is approaching that level. The three linebackers we certainly know about, but it's that's my main hang up with the defense right now, is that there's just a bunch of guys that we don't really know much about. And the guys that we do know something about, it's not all that positive. It's just, there's a lot of question marks here, both in terms of new players and in that most of the guys returning weren't very good last season. And I think the system change will certainly be helpful for Ohio State's defense and for what it wants to do. But I just, my issues with this defense is that I need to see it play well before I can believe that it can play well, essentially.
Yeah. Who, if Kerry Combs called you up, which I'm sure he does on a regular basis, and asks for your input as to who should be the starting, let's just go cornerbacks, because I assume Josh Proctor is going to be the starter at the single high safety. Who are the guys you would trot out to play corner for Ohio State, at least to start the season?
So I'm of the opinion, I think 7 Banks is fine. I alluded to it. I think he's fine. I don't think he's an amazing player or anything. I think the first round projections are a little silly, but I think he's a capable cornerback. I'm not sure how he'll do as a number one, but Ohio State doesn't really have much of a choice there. I would probably put Ryan Watts opposite him. I've really liked what I've seen from Ryan Watts. He's massive and seemingly pretty good for how young he is. I think that there could be some issues there with sort of silly young guy mistakes, but I think that he's very talented. And unlike the person who a lot of people are projecting there, Cam Brown, he's not coming off of a torn Achilles, which is just, it's really hard to come back from as any kind of football player, but especially a defender who has to react quickly and then has their, you know, body accommodate that kind of thing. It's a difficult injury to come back from for anyone, but especially for a cornerback. So I think I would have Ryan Watts as number two. And then the slot corner, I think, is probably the easiest pick of the bunch in Lathan Ransom.
Yeah.
He was spectacular when he played at the end of last season. He was one of the best defenders on the field when he got onto the field. I'm very interested to see him play. I think that he will be the starter there. I'm curious what they will do with Marcus Williamson, but I don't really think that he is, I don't think he's especially close in terms of talent and what he can do on the field when compared to Ransom, even though you have that extra experience with Williamson. Lathan Ransom is just that good. So I think that that's probably the corner alignment that I would go with.
Yeah. And something you mentioned about Ryan Watts is that because he's young, he very well might have some growing pains, just kind of getting used to playing at this level. And I think you and I are in agreement on this. Like, I would far prefer an athletic guy who makes some silly and boneheaded mistakes at times, as opposed to a guy who's older and not as athletic. I would take those things. We've seen the opposite of that with Ohio State at other, specifically defensive positions in recent years, which we don't need to beat up on that guy. He's gone. We don't need to talk about him too much. But I would much rather just throw Ryan Watts out there, throw Lathan Ransom out there, throw Legend Cavazos out there, throw Cam Martinez out there. I'm fine with those guys playing, getting burnt every once in a while, because I think they'll have the upside of being super athletic and young and kind of just doing stuff that we don't necessarily know that they're capable of, but I think once they're given the opportunities, they'll be able to show us a little bit more than we've seen from some of those older guys who've just been, as you said, fine.
For sure. I'm of the opinion with most things, but especially with college football, that if you don't have a great option that you know you can trust to make plays at any position, you should probably go with the guy that has more upside. I don't think that there's a ton of benefit to playing a senior that you kind of know isn't all that special, as opposed to a freshman who's going to make mistakes but has that athletic upside, because at least the latter will be productive. You'll be able to grow this player, and you'll have a movement, you know, a youth movement moving forward. Next season, you would have, you know, someone like Ryan Watts coming back that could step into a star cornerback role, someone like Lathan Ransom who could step into a star cornerback role. Whereas if you play Marcus Williamson, who seems like, I think he's a fine player, I just don't think he's that much better than Lathan Ransom. I think he's probably worse, honestly, but even if he was a little bit better, I don't think that he gives you that much more than Lathan Ransom, and you're not really getting anything from him after this season. So it's, you know, if Marcus Williamson was the star, then obviously you play him this year. But when the talent is relatively equated, I don't think that there's really any reason to go with the older guy. I'm curious if Ohio State will actually do that this season, because that has not been the approach in the past. But I think that having someone like Ryan Watts, having someone like Lathan Ransom, having youth around this defense, you know, getting Jack Sawyer into the game at defensive end is valuable, obviously not just for this season, but for trying to get the defense back to competent and trying to reinstall the stars onto this defense. I think that a big reason that they just didn't have that last year, or, you know, presumably this season, is that they weren't ever playing young guys. It was just cycling through vets, and eventually you're going to miss on some of those vets. And I think that's what last season was, and what I kind of fear for this defense might be this season if they don't make that youth movement push.
So on the defense, to kind of wrap this up before we talk about the fun offensive stuff, is there a guy or two that you think is going to have a breakout season? You mentioned the fact that Haskell Garrett is probably the most reliable and potentially even the best defensive player that they have coming back in a role that he more or less played the season ago. But they've got a lot of interesting guys who, either were backups last year or were dealing with injuries last year or potentially weren't on the team last year. Is there a guy or two that you think could be a significant difference maker for this defense and potentially move them up a rung in terms of their defensive output as opposed to what they did in 2020?
My guy that I have sort of fixated on for this role is Craig Young. He looked so good in the spring game. He's looked so good in what little we've seen of him. He is such a specific and unique athlete in what he is capable of doing. I really, really like him in that bullet role. I think that he's built extremely well for what they ask him to do. And I think that he's going to be a pretty massive positive for this defense if he can play as well as he has looked in brief moments, both in coverage and in stopping the run, even rushing the passer. The other guy is at the same position in Ronnie Hickman. I really liked what I saw from him against Michigan State. He looked like he wanted to get arrested out there, which is always a really good sign for a for a young defensive player, is when they just look like a crazy person on the field, and he certainly did. I believe there was a play where he sort of got into a scrap after a tackle, and the first guy out onto the field was Alabama legend Jameson Williams. Like Ronnie Hickman has that sort of that energy to him, and that's always just a brand of guy that I really like, and so I'm sort of rooting for him to break out because of that specifically. But I think that the bullet position is going to be the one that yields new talent that people didn't really realize could do what we were going to see from them this season. I've been singing the praises of and the values of a two bullet system, which I don't think we're going to see. I suppose you could call it like the double barrel or something. But,
oh, I like that. That's good. It's clever.
With four down linemen, one linebacker, possibly the Tennessee transfer. What is it, Henry
Toe.
With him at linebacker in the middle, and then two bullets behind him, and then four defensive backs, which is part of my master plan evil agenda to eliminate the linebacker position.
Yeah, makes sense.
But it is also my actual football idea that I think would work for this roster. But I could see either one of those guys breaking out. Really, just whoever gets the start at bullet, I think, is going to be one of the best players on the defense pretty much from day one. They're both just so special as athletes, and have really not shown me anything to be, you know, questioning at this point. I've only seen good things from them so far, and certainly they're not only going to do good things on the field, but I think that they're talented enough that they can be immediate impact guys, either one of them, when they're on the field.
And you didn't even mention the fact that Court Williams is probably still in that mix, a guy who a year ago in spring, I think he got hurt the week before the first game. Like, he was somebody who had more buzz than anybody on Ohio State's defense. So we assume that he'll be back 100% by the time, you know, fall camp rolls around. But he's going to be in that mix, too. And I'm not sure if they keep all three of those guys in the bullet where, like you said, unless they, you know, unless Kerry Combs actually does call you up and listen to you, I don't think they're going to be running multiple bullets out there at a time. So I don't know if they want all of that talent blocked up in one spot, but it's an exciting problem to have, I guess.
Yeah, the three bullet defense is a dream that I won't even dare to dream quite yet.
Yeah. All right. So let's move over to the offense where things are a little bit more bright and sunshiny. Let's start with, we've been talking about young guys. Let's start with Trevion Henderson. How good is he? Is he the best running back in Ohio State history? Is he the best running back since Eddie George, since Ezekiel Elliott? Is he J.K. Dobbins? Where is he slotted in for you, at least coming into his freshman season, since we actually haven't seen him play a single down of collegiate football yet?
I really like Trevion. I'm not sure if I'll go quite that far yet, but he's a really special athlete. He's a really, I mean, he looks natural back there. And it's, I was thinking about this last night. I was bummed about the way that we talk about running backs, just generally speaking. And the loss of value in the running back position.
Yeah.
That's not going to change with Trevion Henderson. He's not going to, you know, stop analytics or things like this, but he is the kind of guy who, you know, 15 years ago we would have looked at as like, this is a future Heisman winner guaranteed. This is a future national title winner kind of running back. And I do think he is that kind of guy. It's just that the offenses have changed and the discourse has changed. And I think he's going to, because of that talent, I think he will see the field in year one. I think that I don't, I am not of the opinion that he will be starting in year one. I don't think he's going to quite get to that level. If I'm being honest, I think that Mayan Williams is going to be the starter, which is fine.
I'm on record as saying I think Master Teague is the third, maybe fourth best running back in that room. So I'm right. I think he still might be the starter anyway, but I think he's the third or fourth best, most talented back.
Yeah, I think that it probably goes Henderson, maybe Evan Pryor, just in terms of sheer talent, Williams, Crowley, and then maybe Teague. Master Teague is capable. Yeah. When you have these kind of guys, I think that you have to try and it's your job to get the best one on the field. And I think that at the beginning of the season, at least in terms of both talent and preparedness, it's probably going to be Mayan. But I think that Henderson is 1B in this scenario. I think that Williams is the main guy, but Henderson is not far behind him. Partially because of how good he is as a runner, but I think almost more importantly because of what he can do in the passing game. Ohio State did not do checkdowns last season. Justin Fields had very little interest in throwing the ball shorter than 30 yards on most plays.
Yeah. And it worked.
Yeah, it was fine. It got the job done. But I don't think that's going to be the case this year. I'm going to guess that CJ Stroud is probably the quarterback, and I don't think he's going to want to do that as frequently as Justin Fields did. And it's a nice benefit to a young quarterback to have a running back who can catch the ball out of the backfield. And I think Henderson is pretty obviously the best on the team at that. I would have Marcus Crowley as number two behind him. And I think Marcus Crowley is going to play this season as sort of a 2A situation with Teague as 2B. I do think all four of them are going to see the field though, which could be a too many cooks situation, but who's to say? I guess we'll have to cross that bridge when we get to it. I think that Henderson will absolutely play, though. I think he'll probably see the second or third most carries on the team, and then a surprising amount of targets for an Ohio State running back, given that hasn't really been a part of the offense ever, at least not for a very long time. You'd probably have to go back to like they might have done it with Michael Wiley. But for the most part, Ohio State running backs don't catch the ball. And I think that Henderson sort of bucks that trend in a way that makes a lot of sense for Ryan Day's offense. And this is something that I have been sort of standing on the table for a couple of years saying, hey, they should probably have a running back who can catch the football out of the backfield because it would add value to the offense. And it seems like Travion Henderson kind of fits that that mold. So I think that that's what he'll do early on. I think he's going to excel in that role.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the fact that you think CJ Stroud is going to be the starter. I think everybody agrees on that. I don't think we need to beat that point into the ground. I feel like everybody is kind of on the same page that he will be the starter. Maybe do it for 1 year, maybe 2 years, and then Quinn Ewers comes in and takes over. I'm kind of the assumption that Jack Miller might be gone by the fall, even though I think Ryan Day will try to keep all three, and then and Kyle McCord knew what he was getting into when he came and just might never have the opportunity, which is fine. You want guys to compete, but I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on quarterback. Is there anything else though that you want to throw in before we move off of that topic?
Not a ton. I think that the quarterback room is not in as bad a place in terms of like the guys who don't win the job as it was a couple months ago because of the one-time transfer rule, right? Like I think you can now, as a quarterback, you can go to a school where you have competition like this, see if you can win the job in like Kyle McCord's case. And if you don't, it's really not a huge deal. He could go to, you know, Penn State or wherever next season and be fine.
Michigan.
And that's good. That's good. I think that's helpful for the players. And honestly, it's helpful for the teams because they can still have these competitions and they can go out to the transfer portal and get somebody to back up their quarterback and it's all fine. The only real thought that I have on the quarterback position is I think that Stroud is going to be the starter. I would probably pick McCord just because I like things that are fun. And I think he's the most fun option. But I'm not, you know, getting paid millions of dollars to win football games. And so that's not really the kind of decision that you make when you're getting paid that much.
Ryan Day's not a huge gunslinger fan, I don't think.
No, he needs to let me get in his ear and then he will be. I think my only real quarterback take is that I think Quinn Ewers is the starter next season. And that's I think that he is. I think he's going to Trevor Lawrence someone, presumably CJ Stroud. I don't think that CJ Stroud is Kelly Bryant. I think he's better than Kelly Bryant was, but Quinn Ewers is just that good. I think that Quinn Ewers is a day one starter, regardless of what Ohio State says in the spring and leading up to the fall. I think it's going to be Quinn Ewers in the first game in 2022.
Wow. So you think C.J. Stroud is a one-year starter, gets supplanted by a true freshman. Would that be Ohio State's first true freshman starting quarterback since Art Schleister? Or was there one in between? Because JT wasn't a true freshman.
Braxton would have done it.
Braxton did. Okay.
Yeah, Braxton did it in 2011. Didn't do it especially well, but he did. He took over for...
Was it game one, though?
I don't think so. No, okay. Game one starter, you might have to go back a ways because he took over in like game three from Ballesterman.
Okay. Well, that was, even if it wasn't great, it was still better than the alternative. All right. So let's move off of some of the Ohio State specific stuff, because despite the fact that you are the grand poobah of Buckeye Sports Bulletin, you also do a lot of other things. You have another podcast and you also have a newsletter that you send out every week or multiple times a week. Is it? I'm a subscriber, but time's a flat circle. So I don't.
It is a thrice weekly newsletter.
Yeah. So the Outside Zone, and we'll have links to this in the show notes and in the article version. And you are currently in the middle of what I have to feel like is probably one of the things that you love doing the most. You are in the middle of your G5 preview. Are you doing every single G5 team?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Every single one. In what order are you doing these?
So these are reverse order of Bill Connolly's SP Plus rankings from the end of 2020. Okay. I started at 130, and every time I see a G5 team, I add them to my list. I'm about 25 teams in. I'm doing Kent State today, which is nice. Weird that they're this low. I'm going to do every single one of them. I'm going to take a big nap when I'm done.
Yeah, I imagine. So I know a couple weeks ago, I remember that the everybody's favorite, at least sweatshirt of a football team, the Hawaii Rainbow Warriors were in there. So that was a fun one. Who else of the ones you've done so far? I think it's 27, actually. I'm looking at your site right now.
Okay.
27, the Florida Atlantic Owls, who are just an hour and a half to 2 hours away from me down here in Florida. Who of those 27 teams that you've done so far sticks out as a team that might be able to jump up the SP Plus rankings this season?
Oh gosh, there are a couple that I'm very high on. Allow me to pull up the list real quick so that I'm not just trying to remember off the top of my head. There are a couple that I would have to really sell someone on to convince them. Like you'd have to be a real sicko to immediately believe this kind of thing, which I am, obviously. The first one that comes to mind is, man, it's probably Charlotte. I'm very intrigued by Charlotte just as a program.
Musa Jallo influence.
Yeah, of course. Yes, the Musa Jallo influence. I like Will Healy, the head coach there, quite a bit. Honestly, Texas State, I think, is going to be really fun. They have like a 5'10" pop gun arm quarterback who does a little bit of everything. South Alabama has new head coach is Kane Womack, who Ohio State fans would know as the defensive coordinator at Indiana that gave Justin Fields all sorts of hell for half of the game. He's really good. I don't know if they're going to be good this season, but he is worth at least mentioning. I've sort of been mired in the not very good teams so far because I am doing reverse order. Eastern Michigan is another one that I think is going to have a really fun offense, and then a whole lot of not much on the other side of the ball. But it's been kind of slogging through these bad teams. Once I get to the good teams, man, it's over.
For somebody who like watches Ohio State football and then watches like the big game for the SEC on CBS and then maybe dips into, you know, watch some Clemson stuff and maybe some of the fun air raidy Big 12 stuff and then just Pac-12 after dark, sell people on the joys of G5 college football if all they know are the blue bloods in the Power 5 conferences.
Okay, so I have to make it's less of a it's less of a like a quantified or factual argument here. It is an emotional one.
Okay.
Watching G5 football, doing this kind of thing is absolutely a It is more of an emotional experience than it is a good football experience. There are great football teams at this level. Really fun offenses. Coastal Carolina was a blast to watch last season. BYU was a blast to watch last season. But there are a lot of teams down here, like I'm looking at the top of my preview list right now, like UMass, like Bowling Green, like UTEP, like Akron, that aren't going to win a whole lot of football games and aren't going to look especially good in the games that they do win, and they're going to look really bad in the games that they don't win. There are just a lot of programs like that. It's an unfortunate way that it is. But the appeal here, and the thing that has really sort of gotten its hooks into me, is the culture around these programs. The fact that all of these teams, or at least most of them, have their own little fan bases. They have their own cultural, you know, traditions. They have tailgates. They have things that they care about and things that they value and coaches that they value in their history or right now. The one that comes to mind for me right away, and I've talked about this before on the newsletter, I think I've probably done it on a podcast at least, is going down and watching an Appalachian State Georgia Southern game in Boone a couple years ago. On it was like a Thursday night. I went down with my dad, and it was we stayed in Boone. It was pouring rain. Stadium was absolutely packed. It was full, and there were people. It was freezing. This was like the worst weather I've ever been a part of. It was freezing. It was pouring rain. And there are people there who are, you know, like not college kids. These are adult men who are just shirtless, losing their minds, just absolutely freaking out at this. And it was not a very good football game. It was, you know, really cold and sloggy. But there were people tailgating before the game, and there were people losing their minds throughout the game, and it stayed packed the entire time. I think App State ended up losing, if memory serves, but those two have a decades-long rivalry. I believe, if memory serves, it's called Deeper Than Hate. That's like the actual name of the rivalry.
That's healthy.
Yeah, and they despise each other. These two teams hate each other because every single year when they were at the FCS level, they would meet in the playoff, and then one of them would knock the other one out. And so eventually they just started playing every year because they kept beating each other in the FCS playoffs. And it became this whole thing where I think it was Irk Russell was the longtime coach at Georgia Southern and established this, you know, this culture where Georgia Southern runs the option. That's what Georgia Southern does, is that they run the triple. That's how they win. And App State doesn't. App State likes to run the football. App State likes to sort of grind it out and play like that. But they always, it's that clash of styles. It's the clash of what is admittedly two very similar cultures. And they just, they have this rivalry, and they play every year and they hate each other. But it's something that if you didn't go looking for it, you would never know that this is a rivalry. You would never know that these two teams have this thing going on, and that, you know, their games are always really intense and really hard hitting, and they take it very seriously. You wouldn't know that if you didn't go looking for it. And I have found in just, you know, less than a year of doing this, there are so many stories like that at the G5 level, where there are these just interesting programs, interesting coaches, interesting guys who just don't really fit in the traditional college football mold, if that makes sense. You know, you're not going to find Justin Fields down here at this level, because the guys go to Ohio State, they go to Alabama, they go to Clemson. But you're going to find coaches who are doing weird things, and players who are just, you know, they look weird, they look different, they don't do things the standard way. And it's just, it's really interesting. It's really interesting to see these guys who, it almost has like a Moneyball athletics situation to it, where you have these guys who, they still get the job done. They're still really good football players. They just look weird. And so you have these offenses that just look weird, like Coastal Carolina's. And it's just the G5 culture in college football is I think a lot more, I guess diverse would be the right word, than the top of the sport, at least in my view, because the top of the sport is so min-maxed. It's so designed around what is the most efficient way that we can do this. And that's fine. You're trying to make money. You're trying to win championships. But the way that I consume the sport is in, you know, as best I can, in an emotional way. And that's the way that I think that college football was sort of meant to be consumed. And I think that the G5 is kind of the epicenter of that culture of American football that has kind of left the upper ranks of the P5, at least in a lot of ways. Whereas down here at this level, it's still there in a lot of these games. You still have these things where it hasn't been touched by the, you know, the money-making schemes of the television companies or things like that. It is just purely like, no, these guys just hate each other. These guys actually straight up hate each other. And it's just, it's a lot more fun for me to follow because you get all these unique schools and these unique offenses, and you don't have, you know, 60 teams running the exact same Jeff Lebby inspired offense where that's, you know, glance RPO, screen RPO, glance RPO all the way down the field. You have different stuff going on, and it's just, it's been more interesting for me to follow than anything that I have seen at the Power Five level in several years, I think.
So we know, both of us know, that a non Power Five team is probably not getting into the college football playoff, at least as it stands at four teams. But if there was a team this coming season that you think could contend or at least be in that conversation, much like Cincinnati was last season, who would that be going into 2021?
I think it's still Cincinnati. I think it's friend of the the Ohio State program, Luke Fickell. He has built such a strong program down there. They return just about everybody. I know that James Hudson, the offensive tackle, is gone. They lost a couple of defenders, but Desmond Ridder is back and was quietly really, really good at the end of last season, like weirdly good relative to what he had done up to that point.
Yeah.
Their offense should take a step forward. I'm a little concerned about the loss of Marcus Freeman, who I think is one of the best defensive coordinators in the country at any level. And I don't know how the replacing of him will go, but Luke Fickell is still in charge, and it is Luke Fickell's defense in a lot of ways. But Cincinnati plays Indiana, it plays Notre Dame. It will have opportunities to beat big name teams, two teams that I think are going to finish probably in the top 15. If it can win both of those games and then run the table in the American, I think it will have as good a case as just about anybody. It won't
love
get in. because this is the nature of the beast. But an undefeated Cincinnati, if it does what it has in front of it, if it can accomplish this and you know, tear through this schedule, beat Notre Dame, beat Indiana, and then look dominant against the American, I think it would absolutely have as good a case as like a one loss Clemson, a one loss Alabama, whatever it might be. And I would, you know, I would lose my mind trying to make that case and still see them finish sixth in the final rankings. But I think if anybody from this rank is ever going to make it, it would be this year's Cincinnati team.
Well, one way that I know that we can guarantee that there is a non-Power 5 team in the college football playoff is if we expand it to 356 teams.
Yes.
Which you did on your non-BSB podcast, Flipping the Field. What did you come up with in this 356 team playoff? How does this work? Why would we want this to work? And as everybody who argues against college football playoff expansion will say, how will it impact the regular season?
Okay, so I do have unfortunate news. The name of the show was a bit. We did not actually create a 356 team playoff. No, we did talk through some playoff expansion proposals. The main one being sort of the expansion to 8, the expansion to 12 as an option, the expansion up to 16 even. The one that I find myself coming back to is 12. You would get the first four teams, the top four teams get a first round bye, which means that the top four seeds are still important and valuable because you don't have to play that extra game. 5 through 8 get a first round home playoff game, and then 9 through 12 get to be in the playoff. So I think that there is something beneficial for every team in there to have qualified for what they have qualified for. And the main thing that we see when talking about playoff expansion, the main talking point and the one that I have tried as hard as I can to push back against is that it will devalue the regular season.
Right. Which is dumb.
And one of the things that we talked about on that episode is that it's already devalued like a lot. For some teams, the regular season is essentially a waste of time. Like there are you know, maybe 10 teams that can make the playoff in any given year. So for 120 teams, it already doesn't really matter. And then for those 10 teams, four of them aren't going to lose any games because they, you know, they're just waiting to play.
Yeah,
they're waiting to play each other. It's like the, you know, some of the soccer leagues in Europe where I think it's like PSG doesn't really do anything for their actual league season because they're just preparing for the Champions League. They're just preparing for the you know, European play, and not they know that they're going to win in France if they just barely try. And it's like really, it's, you know, it's like that for Ohio State and for Alabama and for Clemson and to an extent for Oklahoma, where you know these teams aren't going to lose in conference. They don't ever lose in conference unless something has gone seriously wrong. And so you kind of, it's already devalued. There's not a value in that. It's you know who's going to be in the playoff every year. And if you expand it to 12, suddenly a lot more teams can get in, and suddenly it's a lot more valuable to focus on that regular season, to win games, to be, you know, you can be a G5 team and make the playoff. You can be Indiana and make the playoff. You can be Iowa State and make the playoff, which I don't think they can do right now. And I think that it absolutely makes those games more valuable. It makes it, you know, being 11-1 is that much more important. Being 10-2 is that much more important. Whereas right now, you go 10-2 or 11-1, you're still not going to make the playoff. And there's really not much you can do about it because there are the four teams that will always be in it. And so that's sort of the case that I tried to make. I think Ryan is in favor of an 8-team playoff, if memory serves. But I think that expansion would be a good thing entirely because it would just get more teams involved. I think that we need to, for the sport to continue to grow and even to survive, there has to be more than five teams competing for this. It can't just be the same five every single year, because eventually people will tune out. I mean, I cover one of the five teams and I'm bored with it. Like, it's just, it's very, it wears on you to see the exact same teams in there every single year. And I think that expansion would at least change who the teams are, which would be beneficial in a couple ways, because I think we just need some new faces.
Yeah, and even if it doesn't change those four or five teams still getting in, there will at least be other teams that get the opportunity. And I'm with you. I'd always been like Ryan and said an 8-team playoff is what I think they should go to yesterday. But the 12, I like the 12 idea. It does give the incentives for the top four teams already, and you know, it's kind of a tiered level of impact based on where they're seated. So, all right, last most important question, Patrick. How's the cat?
Oh, cat is doing well. Cat is doing well. Okay. I had to do a cat swap of sorts a little while ago. Back in January, late December, something around there, I adopted a kitten whose name is Leon. Leon is a very sweet guy, but I live by myself and I go to work every day. And so I just couldn't keep up with him. So I traded him to my parents in exchange for Wrigley, who's toothless. She's seven. she is the burden of my life and I love her more than anything. She is doing well. She loves to terrorize me at all hours of the day. She's a ragamuffin. I hope that she's currently doing well. When I last saw her as I left for work this morning, she was basking in the sun. So I would assume that she's still doing that. Yeah.
That's life goals right there for her.
Yes, exactly.
For her. Well, Patrick, it's always great to catch up with you. You know, I'm a huge fan of you and what you do. And so continued success with BSB, with Flipping the Field, with Outside Zone. And of course, we'll have links to all of that in the show notes and in the article version. But thanks for taking the time to do this in the middle of what is, as you said, your work day.
Oh, of course. Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Land Grant Holy Land in Conversation. Also, thanks, of course, to the one and only Patrick Mayhorn. We will have links to his Twitter account, Buckeye Sports Bulletin, Outside Zone, and Flipping the Field in the show notes. But do yourself a favor right now and follow Patrick on Twitter at Patrick_Mayhorn. If you are finding this episode on landgrantholyland.com, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We are in week two of our recently relaunched slate of shows here in the podcast feed, but we have more surprises and additions planned for the coming days and weeks. Also, don't forget to follow Land Grant Holy Land on Twitter at LandGrant33. You can find me at BWWMatt. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon. And as always, go Bucks.